This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, in another time, almost another place, this would have been budget week. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, he did deliver a speech at lunchtime, and then this happened.
Late, it's all right. My voice has got out. Like Luke, the owner of a local restaurant and bar, who said JobKeeper saved our bacon.
He's had a test after that. He doesn't have coronavirus. It was just a very inconvenient, dry mouth.
So what was he actually trying to tell us about the economy, Peter?
He said that in this quarter, gross domestic product will fall by more than 10%. That's the biggest fall on record. It means this isn't an ordinary recession, isn't an ordinary depression. Shortly, we'll be joined by one of Australia's experts on depressions and recessions and unemployment. Professor Bob Gregory from the Australian National University has seen more than many. Indeed, he presided over our last full recession at the beginning of the 1990s when he was a member of the Reserve Bank Board. Before we came on air, he told me there are very few experts on recessions in Australia. Do you know why, Gigi?
Maybe we don't have them very much.
That's right. He said, why are you going to spend your time investigating recessions? He said, what are you going to publish, you know, in the 20 years, 30 years? But they're a bit like pandemics. Why would you specialise in them? So Josh Frydenberg said before the coughing fit that the unemployment rate would jump 5 percentage points to more than 10%, but in 3 months, in the space of 3 months. Now, last time it jumped that much, 5 percentage points, it took 3 years. That's the elevator, if you like, for people losing their jobs. Going down at the same time, household spending down 16%, business investment down 18%, and so on. Now, the Reserve Bank put out graphs on Friday, and they show a sort of V-shape. I don't believe it.
Mm. I mean, I do think, we talked about this last week, Peter, I think there is going to be a bit of a bump from people breaking out of quarantine and wanting to go to the restaurant or go to the movies, like I said last week, right? That will happen.
I disagree with you about movies, yeah. but I'll be at the cafe. And yep. They opened in Adelaide this week and the pictures were a delight.
Oh, isn't it great?
It made me want to move there, not that they let me in yet.
But the problem is, I mean, despite that pent-up bit of demand by the people who are a bit richer, who haven't lost their jobs, who haven't been thrown for a loop, that's a kind of a temporary thing. Yeah, we can all start buying coffees again, but what about the other effects that the economy has felt and will be weathering for some time? So that's what we're going to be talking about with Bob Gregory. So one of the things, Peter, that I always like to ask is when someone reports a statistic, a number, in an economic forecast or an economic report, what is it that's so important about that measure? Why specifically are we looking at that? And one of the measures that I've seen a bit talked about and I think is important around the place is measures of sentiment, measures of confidence, and even the extent to which people are saving rather than spending. Because in the longer run, medium to long run, yeah, we may have this pent-up demand to get a coffee, but if we are saving a larger fraction of every dollar we earn...
The savings rate jumped from just a few percent to 10% after the global financial crisis.
It's extremely
high. And that is not
high.
Good. Now, it makes sense to save.
No, of course it does individually, but as a whole economy problem, it's massive. And the U.S. savings rates have been reported recently. They're right up there with the, you know, historical or highest savings rates. One of the problems Japan has had as well is, you know, too much savings for many, many years.
We should mention the unemployment rate in the U.S., which also came out on Friday. That's almost 15% now. And bear in mind, the U.S. keeps a fair portion of its population in prison. So it's
there,
2 million people out of 330. Yep. So you've always got to adjust its unemployment rates for that. This is The Economists on Radio National. I'm an economics editor. Gigi Foster is a professor of economics. And we're about to be joined by one of Australia's preeminent economists. You get to be called preeminent when they name something after you. The Gregory Effect is named after Bob Gregory. And Gregory has been charting the path ahead. Bob Gregory is a professor of economics at the Australian University, an officer of the Order of Australia, and was for 10 years through the second half of the 80s and the first half of the 90s, a member of the Reserve Bank Board. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being on the program, Bob.
Now, am I right in what I said before, that this is a recession like no recession before it?
look, this is completely new and completely different. And that's a real puzzle and a problem for all of us, because this recession is a long way different from anything we've experienced before. And we'll see that over the next year as things unfold, because output falls in the short term are going to be much, much bigger than anything we've experienced before. And then the question is going to be, will the recovery, at the beginning, it's going to be different and worse. The recovery, we just don't really know yet, because we haven't got started on the recovery, I'm afraid.
Every other recession has been begun, certainly the one that you presided over, or maybe accidentally helped cause, the last big recession, has really been set off by high interest rates, right?
That's correct. You see, to some extent, all previous recessions since World War II have been government-induced in response to the fact that the economy wasn't doing well in the government's eyes, basically too much inflation. And so, you know, they turned up the interest rate, as it were, and that happened slowly, and the response to that was slow. And the response was focused on those parts of the economy which were interest rate sensitive. This has been quite different. In this one, interest rates are low. The government has generated this recession by closing things down itself, and closing things down which are sectors which are different from those that are normally affected at the beginning of the recession.
So normally housing would be one of those normally affected, right?
Yeah. Normally you see housing, manufacturing, investment, construction. You don't see coffee shops, restaurants, retail stores at the beginning. It's quite different in the industries it affects at the beginning. It's quite different in the speed, and it's quite different in terms of the turnoff. With previous recessions, the turnoff is the interest rates get lowered after some time, and that takes a while. Here, the turnoff will take a while, but it'll be quite different again. It'll be which sectors do we open and how do we open them and so on.
So there's a bit of a narrative at the moment that once coffee shops and cafes and restaurants are opened, that there will be some pent-up demand, as we say in economics. People who have been just dying for that, you know, cappuccino soy explosion, and so they go out and buy it, and that will help to prop up those sectors a little bit. First of all, do you think that's going to happen? And secondly, is that enough to propel the recovery forward?
First of all, I think that will happen often, but it won't be enough to propel the closed down sectors, because some of the closed down sectors won't get turned on straight away. So turning on restaurants and limiting the number of customers to 10 won't really make any difference at all to restaurants. So I'm expecting some sort of bounce back, but, you know, it won't be strong, and it will wear out too, I think, because, you know, when I get out, I'll probably go and buy a winter shirt and a winter jumper and all this sort of stuff. And a lot of people have got money in the bank which they never had before. So there will be a bounce back. But one of the questions is how long it will go on for and how strong it will be. And I think you can't have a coffee shop restaurant-led recovery, really. And the reason I think that is that after a few months, the nature of this recession is going to change. It's going to change because it's going to start moving into housing construction, housing building. It's going to start moving into the more traditional industries that are affected.
Why do you expect that to happen?
Oh, just because people looking forward can see the economy is going to be depressed. So suppose I'm a spec builder and I'm sitting here now saying, I've got a chance to buy a block of land and build 6 houses. I'll get them finished next year. What's going to happen next year? Well, first of all, the bank's telling me next year's still going to be depressed, you know, unless the bounce back is really strong. Next year, the immigration flow will have cut back, so that'll affect demand. So I think I'm going to hang off.
We're going from 200,000 net migration a year to nothing for a while, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, exactly. So I think there are all sorts of problems looking ahead. Now, of course, maybe at this point, people aren't looking that far ahead. But as the recession goes on, people will start thinking that. I've asked some of my builder friends, you know, and they're saying to me, you know, everything's fine now because they're finishing things. And so they're busy. What they're all worried about is new orders and new flows and new buildings. And the odds are that that'll start to dry up next year.
What you're giving us is individual examples of what we have talked about actually before on the program, which is business confidence, or it was driven by consumer confidence and general sort of animal spirits not being particularly bullish, shall we say. And so it's sort of people's decision-making is linked to what they think other people are going to do. And
yeah, but
and
it's also rational, right? It's also, absolutely, if you know rational. That the population is going to grow much more slowly than it was, you're going to be less likely to build a house.
And we do have measures of this. I mean, we have measures of consumer and business confidence. We also have measures of capacity utilization.
You know, there's something funny, Gigi, which is that the consumer confidence has jumped in the last week. It's got back 70% of its losses in the past 2 weeks. Don't ask me why.
Well, Bob, do you think that's important?
No. Business confidence is bad.
No. I think the general point that you're saying is true, you know, that in general confidence matters. But one thing that we don't want to do is look at these weekly numbers. You know, we don't want to say, oh, the share market went up by 10% last week. The outcomes here are not turning on week to week. I mean, the outcomes in next year are already in place to some extent now. You know, it takes a while for all these things to work out. So I wouldn't be putting a lot of emphasis on short-term confidence and so on. But I tell you what, you don't want people to read the Reserve Bank monetary statement, right?
Because you've just read it, the one that came out on Friday.
Yeah,
Don't
read that, right? Because that says a message which is general professional message, that no matter what happens, things are going to be really grim for 6 to 9 months. And then there'll be a bounce back. But, you know, it's so far ahead, we don't really know. And a lot depends on what happens to coronavirus and so on. So, you know, it looks grim, whichever way you look at it, actually. And it will turn out at the beginning, for sure, to be the worst thing we've had since the 1930s.
But if we draw a V, you can see the beginning of the uptick, the second half of the V. But after that, you see, because of construction, and what about the finance sector too, perhaps, a very slow, long recovery. If you like, it'll look like a reverse tick and then it'll be quite flat.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of interesting because if in Australia, if you look at recessions and recoveries, a lot matters whether you look at GDP or unemployment. Often the recovery will be stronger in GDP and employment terms than it will be in unemployment terms. So, you know, we haven't had a recession where unemployment rate goes to 10% 1 year and back to 5% the next. That is, the labour market outcomes, measured by unemployment and so on, are often different from the GDP outcomes.
This is The Economist on Radio National with me, Gigi Foster, Peter Martin, and Professor Bob Gregory of the Australian National University. We care about these kinds of numbers because they really do mean the livelihoods of people are being threatened. In fact, if the unemployment figures are taking longer to recover, that's generally going to be affecting those who are most disadvantaged already in the communities who were losing their jobs because they were casual workers, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask you, is there a number, is there a figure, a statistic that would be able to capture the degree of regressivity of the recession itself and the recovery?
The search for a figure is hard, but what you said is certainly true, and that is that after the recession starts, say 2 years later, 3 years later, most of the community is sort of fine. They've forgotten about the recession already. They either never lost their jobs or they're fine. It's really the bottom groups that really suffer and take a long time to climb their way out. In Australia, you've seen it first in the unemployment rate. But in other recessions, one of the reasons why the unemployment rate has come down is that in other recessions, people have moved on to other welfare payments. So, you know, if you look at the 91 recession, for example, a lot of the decline in the male unemployment rate came about by people moving on to disability payments. A lot of the decline of the female unemployment rate came about by people moving on to sole parent payments. So I think that's important. But this time around, the government has been trying to close off switching from unemployment into other welfare payments, because other welfare payments pay a bit more money, like disability and so on. So they've tried to close that off. But there's one more thing I should say, which is in previous recessions, because it's been construction and manufacturing, the industries that have been knocked around most have been industries where people work full time. And when people work full time, if they lose their job, they become unemployed. If you have a recession, and I'm exaggerating this now, that's focused on coffee shops and restaurants, most people are working part-time. And so when they lose their jobs, they tend not to go into the unemployment statistics. So this is a quite different in that sense, you know, that the pattern of unemployment is going to be quite different, I think, than, or the pattern of job loss is going to be quite different from the previous recessions.
Are there other things we should know about how the process might play out?
Yeah, I do think there are other things. I mean, what I really want to talk about is we compare this recession to previous recessions, and I say, oh, this one's different. I think a better comparison is between this recession and the recession we didn't have. The really interesting issue looking ahead over a longer horizon is what happened to us in 2007-08.
The GFC non-recession.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at other countries, if I'm in America now and I'm talking about the most serious recession since World War II, I'm talking about the GFC and today. We missed the GFC completely. It was almost as though it didn't exist. And so the question is, you know, we were saved then by something or other. Is there something or other that'll save us this time around? And when I look back to the previous recession, which we didn't have, there were three major reasons why we didn't have that recession. One is the Labor government had a massive program of expenditure, quote, to save us. We've got that. I mean, the Morrison government has even spent more money, and I think that's amazing.
You can't fault it in those terms. No.
No, I think they've done really well on that. Secondly, China saved us. You know, the dramatic impact of China on the Australian economy at that time was enormous. They saved us in terms of very high mineral prices, lots of demand. I don't think looking forward, China can provide that sort of stimulus again for us. In fact, all the political rhetoric we're hearing every day is that, you know, they may be moving in the other direction, partly as a result of our, you know, political stance. And the third thing is because China boosted the Australian economy so much, we were able to have lots of immigrants and lots of students, and which you can think of as a China effect. The immigrant impact was really enormous. We went from, you know, the Howard years of just after 2000, the very low numbers, right up to very big numbers. The foreign students went up to big numbers. This is what worries me, because I think it's a point which is not really discussed much. Currently, we're at the beginning of the major recession, and we've got a lot of discussion about how to open up, how not to open up. Then we've had some discussion about whether there'll be a bounce back, say, in a year's time. We really should be talking as well as where do we think we'll be in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years' time. So when we go back to 2007-08, which we missed, we had three major contributors to our missing that. One was the Rudd expansion of government expenditure. Morrison's done that. Excellent. Well done. The China expansion at that time, which was huge in Australia, this we won't have this time. You can't see looking forward, you know, Australia's trade shares with China going from, say, 30% of our exports to 60%.
Not only because there's a dispute, but also because that can't happen again. You can only do that once.
That's right. That's right. China's bigger, so they'll be demanding more things. That's good. But, you know, China's now looking more inwards itself. So that's going to be a bit tough. And then the last thing is because the China impact was so big, that changed our whole attitude towards immigration and created all these foreign students who came here.
Sorry, how did impact create immigrants and foreign students?
Because the rest of the world, take immigrant first, right? You're sitting in Ireland or somewhere or other, and you're thinking about you're not too happy, you want to migrate. Where would you migrate in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008? I mean, Australia was one of the number one performers. So first of all, the demand for migrants to come here went up, and we were prepared to have them because we didn't have the unemployment rates. You know, I think they do much more to demand creation than they do to you know, stealing people's jobs. So I always see immigrants as a strong positive force. I see if we scale down immigrants from, say, 200,000 to, say, 50 or 60, then that's going to have a huge impact. I mean, that means that half the growth of the labour market in Australia, in terms of demand, sort of disappears.
Bob, final question for you. You're famous in the academic and policy communities for being able to look at pretty much any number or any graph and tell us what it means in terms of what matters. If you had to pick one number or one graph at the moment, some measure that we might not fully appreciate and be able to interpret it and say this measure matters and here's why, which would it be?
That's a good question. And I'm going to give you a strange answer because nobody's much talking about this. When you do a massive stimulus like we have done, going forward, it's important to realize that a lot of that stimulus is one-off, and you don't want that stimulus that we're doing now to get mixed up with government macro policy in a negative way 2 or 3 years hence. That is, when we start coming out of this, we don't want to be worried about clawing back government deficits or clawing back expenditure that we've made now, because we're not going to get back to, quote, a balanced budget in a decade's time. And so we shouldn't allow the government budget deficit to play the role it's been playing over the last decade. So I'm a little frightened that when we need stimulus in a year's time or 9 months' time, people will be starting to say, oh, we've spent too much. I think that's wrong. I think we've got to think about debt in a much more positive way than we did in the past. That is, we have to think about the increases in debt we've got as a good thing, because that's made a big difference to life over the next year or two. And we shouldn't be racing around trying to claw it back too quickly. Just leave it there until it gradually disappears as time goes by.
Professor Bob Gregory from the Australian National University, thank you so much for being on the program.
It's been really nice talking from quarantine at home.
Thank you. This is The Economists on Radio National with me, Peter Martin, Gigi Foster, and Professor Bob Gregory, trying to make sense of how the coming recession will play out. Gigi, remember that app, the one we talked about a few weeks back? Just like the coronavirus, the curve for it is flattening. It's hard to tell because the government releases the data with a delay, but downloads of the COVID-safe contact tracing app appear to be stalling at somewhere south of 6 million. In the days after it was offered, 3 weeks ago, it generated 500,000 downloads a day. It's now less than 100,000, suggesting something extra might be needed to get people up to that 40% target. Who are you going to call? A behavioural economist. Professor Bob Slonim was until recently research director of the Prime Minister's so-called Beta Behavioural Economics Unit. He's now back at Sydney University and he has concerns. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Thanks for being on the program.
You've written about this in The Conversation this week. What isn't the government doing that it could be doing to boost take-up?
Right. So there are many things that the government is not doing. What I think would be very useful would be if they could provide more details on the downloads, specifically geographically, for instance, by postcodes, by city or state, which I think would be enormously helpful to increasing the take-up.
How would that help?
So first, there's a health perspective. This is going to give the local communities, the state level, the cities, more information on how well they're doing in terms of the app take-up. And this will help them make smarter decisions in terms of whether they are in a situation where they're closer to being able to relax various restrictions. It also lets individuals make better health-wise decisions. If they know that their community is, for example, got 90% tracing versus, you know, a very low level of tracing, this can affect, for example, how often they want to go out, how comfortable they're going to feel going out, whether they want to wear a mask and how much aggressively they're going to practice social distancing. Another advantage is motivational. And I think surely this information is going to help to boost people's interest in downloading the app. So we know that people are very motivated by how well their local community is doing in other areas in terms of community service and helping the public. It's going to remind them, give them pride in trying to boost and make that look better. The other, and I think really important issue here, to trust them, to say, go ahead, please download this. And I think they can reciprocate the trust, which will then motivate more people to download it. We were able to start to see that direct link between the people downloading it, let's say in Melbourne, they're having a high rate of downloads, and we start to see restrictions being relaxed there more as a consequence. That in turn will then cycle back, motivating more people to download it.
Do you think the government is actually drawing on expertise of behavioral economics and people like yourself, basically, in delivering the policy or the approach to attempting to get more downloads that that it has been doing?
I have not seen that. And I find this very frustrating because we could tap into, it's not just behavioral economists, and there is the behavioral economics team that's in the Prime Minister and Cabinet, they could tap in. But we also have, you know, just brilliant people in the advertising industry. We have, this is what we have experts in. And in this particular case, you know, around a pandemic, this might be an ideal opportunity to get the best talent in the room and have them work on this. You know, I'm a big fan of the Green Transfer Show. I'd love to know what they would come up with, what suggestions they would have. And at some point, you know, as we know, a message works or it doesn't. It's probably worked on most of the people it's going to work on. And now we need to think about, well, what about the other 70% of the population that hasn't downloaded this? And what can we do next? One of the suggestions we've also had is you get people, celebrities, sports stars, entertainers to endorse the product. Here, this would be a perfect way to reach different communities that probably haven't as much downloaded the app.
If there was one thing you could suggest, an out-of-the-box idea, what would it be?
I have an idea. And so this is my idea for the moment, and I think I suspect this would be highly successful. My suggestion is that the government makes one more promise, that if we reach a different higher level, let's say 60% of downloads of the app, then they're going to randomly choose one person from all the people that have downloaded the app. And this person then gets to randomly choose one, not randomly, they can choose one member of parliament, and we're going to do a carnival-like event. We can videotape it live. They can pull an electronic lever, and that member of parliament gets to be dunked into a nice bucket of cold water they fall into. Right? I would download the app tomorrow. In fact, I'd try and get 5 new phones and download the app to do this and have that get that rights to do this. And I think, I know it sounds a little funny, tongue-in-cheek, but it's not. I think these are the kinds of ideas that really motivate people. When you see some sort of, you know, direct value, some entertainment to this, that's what an advertising, maybe an advertising wouldn't come up with that one. They'll think we're being too tongue-in-cheek. But the idea is there's so many creative solutions we should be thinking about.
Maybe it's too important not to.
Go ahead, sorry.
Professor Bob Slonim from Sydney University, thanks so much for joining us.
Great, thank you guys, and good luck.
Thank you.
And that's The Economists for this week. We'll put links to the official forecasts about the economy and to Bob Slonim's article on COVIDSafe on our website. That's The Economists at ABC Radio National. That's also where you can send us comments or questions. Click on Contact Us.
And it's where you can listen to this program and all the others again, as well as via The Economists on the ABC Listen app or your podcast app of choice. Gigi, no one would say what we're going through is good, certainly not the Treasurer. But for economists at least, there's a lot to talk about. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.